The Iraqi government dismisses Pentagon's claims about cooperation between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. deadly airstrikes in Syria. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions calls on the U.S. to impose sanctions on the Saudi Crown Prince over his role in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And police in Myanmar's main city, Yangon, use force to disperse people holding a fresh rally against the ruling junta, reportedly killing one protester. Thanks for joining us. Baghdad has denied any cooperation with Washington over Thursday's deadly U.S. airstrikes on eastern Syria near the border with Iraq. In a statement, the Iraqi Interior Ministry said no intelligence was exchanged with U.S.-led coalition forces in Iraq for the raids. The ministry noted that its cooperation with the coalition is limited to boosting Iraq's internal security. The Iraqi Defense Ministry also expressed surprise at Pentagon's claims of intelligence sharing before the attacks on the Syrian territory. The ministry said its cooperation with the U.S.-led forces is restricted to the specific goal of forming the coalition, which is to fight the Daesh terror group. The Pentagon has said that Baghdad helped Washington conduct the raids through its information gathering. U.S. President Joe Biden says the recent American airstrikes on Syria was a warning to Iran that it cannot act with impunity. Biden told reporters during a visit to storm-hit U.S. state of Texas that Tehran should be careful. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, made a similar remark. He said the U.S. administration wanted to make it very clear, notably to Iran, that acting against American people, partners, and interests cannot go with impunity. The U.S. conducted airstrikes on Syria's eastern province of Deir al-Zor near the Iraqi border on Thursday. The attack was the first of its kind under the Biden administration and targeted facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemns the U.S. airstrikes in eastern Syria as a violation of human rights, international law, and Syria's territorial integrity. The ministry's spokesman said the U.S. strikes are in line with Israel's aggression against Syria and would increase instability and military encounters. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the U.S.'s years-long presence in Syria is illegal and accused the U.S. of occupying the Syrian soil and stealing its natural resources, including oil. Khatibzadeh said the illegal U.S. bases in Syria are used for training terrorists. On Thursday, the U.S. launched overnight airstrikes on facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. The attack was ordered by U.S. President Joe Biden. Syria also strongly condemned the move.
The Syrian Arab Republic condemns in the strongest terms the U.S. aggression against its sovereignty, which contradicts the terms of international law and the United Nations Charter, and with its role as a permanent member of the Security Council.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry warned that the U.S. aggression would lead to repercussions that escalate the situation in the region. Iraqi resistance movements also condemned the attacks. Iraq's Kataib Hezbollah group slammed the strikes as barbaric aggression. The Secretary General of the Ba'ath organization, Hadi al-Amari, called on the Iraqi government to investigate the U.S. strikes. In a statement, the al-Nujaba Islamic Resistance Movement stressed that the U.S. attacks would not go unanswered. International lawyer Barry Grossman says Washington, with its airstrikes on Syria, targeted those who are truly fighting the U.S.-backed terrorism.
Let's be clear about this. The U.S. claims ostensibly that this bombing run was an act of retaliation carried out in defense of U.S. troops. The U.S. chose at this point in time to bomb those sites and to target elements working with the Iraqi government. These militia forces are there fighting what we've come to call terrorist elements, which were trained, armed, and supported by the U.S. Very effectively, whereas the United States military has been in very clear terms asked by the Iraqi government to leave and nevertheless remains in Iraq. So it's a bit rich for the Americans to be saying that this was some kind of a defensive strike.
Calls are growing for Washington to impose sanctions on the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman following a U.S. intelligence report implicating him in the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The U.N. Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions urged Washington to target personal assets and international engagements of bin Salman. Agnes Callamard said the U.S. should not give the Saudi prince immunity from civil suits. Advocacy groups for press freedom have made similar requests. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has announced that his country is taking concrete steps to recalibrate relations with Riyadh. He said that Washington is imposing visa restrictions on 76 Saudi individuals. The Crown Prince, however, is not among them. That is despite a bombshell intel report which shows bin Salman had personally approved the murder of Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Well, a report from the U.S.'s intelligence community has definitively blamed Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman for the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. However, Joe Biden's refusal to sanction the Crown Prince, combined with new airstrikes in Syria, has many saying the horrific murder has produced no real change in bilateral relations. Robin Mazzari has more from Chicago.
A long-delayed intelligence report by the United States into the gruesome killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi did not contain any major revelations, but did agree with the widespread assessment that the murder was ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, the 35-year-old Saudi Arabian crown prince, widely considered the de facto ruler of the kingdom. While on the election campaign, new U.S. President Joe Biden called Saudi Arabia a pariah state with no redeeming social value. However, he ultimately blocked any penalties or visa ban on the crown prince, despite the report's admission that the U.S. has credible information that he committed a gross human rights abuse. That has many saying that the shocking assassination will have had no change on the extremely close ties between Washington and the far-right Saudi monarchy.
No, it will not change. There will be some, I would say, cosmetic, so we call it politically cosmetic changes, such as condemnations or the condemnation, sort of formal condemnations and arms in the air, metaphorically in the air, but very little change.
Biden called the Crown Prince's father, King Salman, before the report's release, but reportedly only to stress the strength of their bilateral ties and their mutual antagonism towards Iran. Shortly afterwards, Biden then bombed the first country of his presidency, Syria, with deadly and illegal airstrikes.
Too many interests there at stake. The arms, which are sold dramatically to, you know, by the United States and particularly England, the oil, of course. From my point of view, Saudi Arabia cannot be disjoined from Israel. So an advice about Saudi Arabia would have to be subscribed, or rather would become second to advice about Israel.
One of Khashoggi's most popular topics at the Washington Post was fomenting war against Iran. Another was encouraging neoliberal economic changes, which many said would lead to the denationalization of Saudi Arabian oil into the hands of Western high finance. Khashoggi's writings were unabashedly supportive of the House of Saud, but he encouraged a constitutional monarchy as opposed to their current absolute monarchy. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Chaotic scenes in Myanmar, where police have used force against crowds protesting the military rule. Officers in riot gear fired rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse protesters in the main city of Yangon and elsewhere. Protesters chanted slogans against the military, calling its chief a crazy dictator. Local media say that a woman was shot dead during a rally in the town of Manwaya. An unknown number of people, including media workers, were also arrested. Myanmar has been shaken by a wave of protests since a military coup toppled de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi on February the 1st. Suu Kyi and much of her party leadership are in custody over allegations of fraud in a November election that they won. South Korea has started vaccinating healthcare workers against the coronavirus one day after launching its national vaccination campaign. About 55,000 medical workers will receive Pfizer vaccine doses, while some 290,000 will be given AstraZeneca jabs. South Korea kicked off its vaccination drive by dividing shots to nursing home workers and some patients at COVID facilities. Authorities say over 1,800 people have already received the first doses of AstraZeneca on the first day of the campaign. The government plans to vaccinate at least 70% of the country's population by November to reach herd immunity. South Korea has so far recorded more than 89,000 infections and nearly 1,600 COVID deaths.
Across South Korea, vaccinations against COVID-19 began, with more than 5,000 nursing home residents and care providers scheduled to get their jabs by the end of the day.
I was thinking of the elderly patients at our nursing home who have been exhausted and sad about not being able to see their families, so I'm glad to be the first person to be vaccinated. I hope herd immunity is established so that our patients can see their families and everyone can return to daily life without masks.
President Moon Jae-in observed people getting their shots, seeking to encourage people to be vaccinated when it's their turn. South Korean officials say the country should achieve herd immunity by November of this year. Herd immunity is achieved when a high percentage of people have been immunized, preventing the spread of a contagious disease. But about half of South Koreans surveyed are hesitant to get their shots. South Korea had been successful in limiting the spread of COVID-19 during the initial outbreak a year ago, but has seen waves of the virus infect hundreds of people each day since November last year.
There are many reasons why I will get my shot right away, but I think during the last year of COVID-19, the government has done well to prevent it spreading, so I trust them in terms of the vaccine.
South Korea has received vaccines, but I'm hesitant to get it. It's because in the UK, many cases of side effects have been reported, so I'm a bit reluctant. I want to watch what happens, and I'll get it if it's okay then.
Seoul's November goal of herd immunity may also be complicated by supply chain challenges and drug-resistant variants of COVID-19, with a return to normality more likely in 2022. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Local authorities in Brazil are resorting to new lockdowns and curfews to control the surge in the COVID-19 outbreak in the country. The country's capital city, Brasilia, was put on a 24-hour lockdown on Friday, leaving open only essential services. A dozen other state capitals have also imposed lockdowns, with some declaring nighttime curfews. This comes as the country's coronavirus death toll topped 251,000 after over 1,580 deaths were recorded Thursday. That is the second highest daily toll, and unseen since the peak of the pandemic in July. Despite the surge, President Jair Bolsonaro once again criticized the lockdowns, threatening governors to cut off federal emergency assistance if they don't lift the restrictions. EU leaders expressed concern over the spread of COVID-19 variants within the 27-nation bloc amid criticism that vaccines are being administered too slowly. The handling of the pandemic in the EU is contributing to economic uncertainty and social inequality. Jerome Hughes has more.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevot feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant, I was managing a restaurant, and I lost my job, and I was like, what I can do next, what we can do, what the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do, because we don't have any help.
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations.
The B117 is by now in all member states but one. The South African variant is in 14 member states and the Brazilian variant in 7. So there's a lot of challenge ahead of us.
Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A sit-in has been staged in Rome in support of millions of Palestinians demanding Israel to comply with its international obligations and to provide them with COVID vaccines. Max Civelli has more.
Rome's Association of Palestinians called a sit-in in the vicinity of the Italian parliament to draw attention on Israel's COVID-19 vaccine program, which excludes the nearly 5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip under Israeli military occupation. The rally was supported by a number of left-wing groups and unions.
The fourth Geneva Convention stipulates that Israel has a responsibility as an occupying power to ensure that medical aid reaches the occupied territories to combat the coronavirus crisis. Responsibilities also include providing vaccines in a non-discriminatory manner to Palestinians under its control.
Israel has the duty to provide COVID vaccines to Palestinians. The question is why nobody talks about it here in Italy. TVs and newspapers praise Israel's vaccination campaign, but they don't say a word about how Israel is a militarized country which is not observing its international obligations and pays each vaccine dose double the price, promising pharmaceutical companies patient data.
While Palestinians' right to health care is undermined, Tel Aviv has pledged to send thousands of spare coronavirus vaccines to foreign allies that have accepted Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem, such as Czech Republic, Hungary and Honduras.
These vaccine donations are the latest example of Israel's new expression of soft power. Tel Aviv rewards or sways those that have little access to vaccines in exchange for their complicity. This confirms the absence of morals and values of Israel.
We are calling on Italy, the EU and international community to take concrete measures to force Israel to provide Palestinians with vaccines. We are not begging, we demand what is ours.
In January, the United Nations voiced its concern over Israel's refusal to vaccinate the Palestinians, but the appeal has gone unheard so far. Max Civili, Rome.
More anti-government protests in Chile turned violent, with police and riot gear clashing with demonstrators in the capital, Santiago. Police used water cannon and fired tear gas to disperse the crowds that were seen throwing rocks at law enforcers and attacking their armored vehicles. The Latin American country has witnessed street protests since late 2019 over social inequality. Demos then started with fare hikes, setting off an intense wave of unrest that led to over two dozen deaths. Later, the police killing of a street artist has intensified the protest. National and international human rights groups accuse security forces of using excessive force against the people expressing their anger at government policies. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
As Tennessee, like other states, embarks on the daunting task of inoculating millions of residents against COVID-19, many health officials find their mission complicated by a pervasive mistrust of government and law enforcement among unauthorized immigrants, a population estimated at 11 million across the U.S., says Sarah Varney, correspondent, in an article published under the heading Anti-Immigrant Racism Complicates COVID-19 Vaccine Rollout in South U.S. Stay tuned for more. In eastern Tennessee, doctors have seen firsthand how a hardline immigration policy can affect the health and well-being of a community. In 2018, federal agents raided a meat packing plant in Morristown, a manufacturing hub in the Tennessee Valley, and detained nearly 100 workers they suspected of being in the country illegally. In the weeks that followed, scores of immigrant families who had found work in meat processing plants dotting broader Hamble County scrambled to find sanctuary in churches and avoided seeking medical care. The reason? Immigration agents were staking out clinics. We did not want people to come in for care because there were IC officers in packing lot, said Parsinda Khatri, chief clinical officer at Cherokee Health Systems, a nonprofit provider in Hamble County. As Tennessee, like other states, embarks on the daunting task of inoculating millions of residents against COVID-19, many health officials find their mission complicated by a pervasive mistrust of government and law enforcement among unauthorized immigrants, a population estimated at 11 million across the U.S. The challenges are particularly acute in southern U.S., where large populations of immigrants living there illegally help maintain the region's thriving agricultural and food processing industries, even as many state and local Republican leaders, emboldened by the Trump administration's 4 years of anti-immigrant vitriol, denounce unauthorized residents as criminals and call for more limited paths to citizenship. The confluence of those aggressive attitudes and a highly contagious virus has prompted concerns in some states that lackluster vaccination of people in the country without legal permission will short-circuit efforts to achieve herd immunity for the broader community. We will never get on top of this pandemic if the undocumented are left out, said Sharon Davis, chief medical officer at Las Berrias Unidos Community Clinic in Dallas, which serves 28,000 patients, the majority of them in the country without authorization. She acknowledged the challenge that poses in a state such as Texas, where the state Republican Party platform calls for the immediate expulsion of all illegal aliens. Echoing clinic directors in many southern states, Davis said, rolling out vaccination plans in immigrant communities is a don't ask, don't tell policy. Davis was among the medical directors who said the mass vaccination sites many states are using in the rollout
giant tents staffed by uniformed National Guard troops and iPad-toting medical personnel have spooked immigrant families. They are asking, "What documentation do we have to show at the mass vaccination sites?" said Davis. "Fear of deportation is just huge and very real." And not unfounded, advocates noted, coming up 4 years in which former President Donald Trump sharply curtailed both legal and illegal immigration through mass detention and deportation, travel bans, and severely restricting asylum. President Joe Biden has pledged to undo many of Trump's policies, but immigrant advocates say support for more drastic measures runs strong among some immigration agents and local law enforcement officers who could make life difficult for immigrants they suspect are in the country illegally. Beyond fear of harassment or arrest, Davis said, public health officials are dealing with misinformation, including widespread rumors about government surveillance efforts secreted in the vaccine. They're hearing horrible stories on social media, she said. They believe there was a microchip in the vaccine and they would be tracked. Even some immigrants living in the U.S. legally have reservations about receiving a government-provided vaccine. The Trump administration pushed to derail citizenship for any immigrant who used taxpayer-funded public services, including health care. In December, the Department of Justice withdrew the rule, but confusion abounds, and clinic directors say patients will prioritize their green cards above almost all else. Sluggish vaccination rates among immigrant populations are already apparent. In Mississippi, for example, the Department of Health reported last week that fewer than 2,800 Latinos have been vaccinated, about 1% of all vaccinations administered so far. Tennessee offers a prime example of the tensions underlying the vaccine rollout. The Republican governor, Bill Lee, made headlines in May when he allowed the State Department of Health to share the names and addresses of those who tested positive for the virus with police. The city of Nashville's health department separately provided local police with the addresses of people who tested positive or were quarantining. Both efforts came under criticism and eventually ended, but Lee defended the effort, saying the information was appropriate to protect the lives of law enforcement and permitted by federal health privacy laws. The city later sought to reassure its diverse immigrant communities that the information would not be shared with federal immigration authorities. Alabama, like Tennessee, has a history of tough rules regarding immigration, including a sweeping 2011 law that bars unauthorized immigrants from receiving nearly all public benefits, including most non-emergency medical care. Velvet Luna, a 26-year-old registered nurse, has built her life in Ozark, Alabama, a small city in Wiregrass, a region known for its poultry processing facilities and large populations of Hispanic and Vietnamese immigrants. Luna enrolled in Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, an Obama-era program that granted temporary status to unauthorized immigrants brought across the border as children. According to the National Immigration Law Center, nearly 500,000 DACA-eligible immigrants are essential workers. Luna, who speaks with a soft southern accent, once freely shared her immigration status, said, "In recent years, men who worked with her would find out my status and would immediately change their attitude toward me. They would say ugly, ugly, hurtful things. You are the reason the U.S. is declining. You need to get out of here." As a nurse at an area hospital who volunteered in the COVID unit, she has received both doses of vaccine, but she understands the risks undocumented families weigh. Neither of her parents, who live close by, are authorized to be in the U.S. It's okay to be scared, and it's a courageous move to go get the vaccine and protect your family, she said. Even hardline immigration opponents acknowledge the pandemic has tied together the fates of everyone living in the U.S. regardless of how they arrived. The main thing is to get shots into as many people's arms as possible. Mark Kerkorian, executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a conservative think tank that strenuously advocates for restricting immigration, said. He added, "Your immigration may catch up with you someday, but that's not today." The Biden administration has said U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement will not conduct enforcement operations at or near vaccine distribution sites. IC does not and will not carry out enforcement operations at or near healthcare facilities such as hospitals, doctor's offices, accredited health clinics, and emergent or urgent care facilities, except in the most extraordinary of circumstances, according to a February 1st statement issued by the Department of Homeland Security. State health commissioners also have tried to calm rattled nerves. "We're not denying vaccine to anyone who shows up at our sites and is in a phase," said Dr. Lisa Pearsley, commissioner of the Tennessee Department of Health. "This is a federal resource, and if you are in this country, then you get a vaccine." Advocates, however, said hurdles remain in convincing very immigrants that the personal information collected as a part of the vaccination process will not be used against them. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention expects providers administering COVID vaccines to upload patient information to state registries, including 10ISS in Tennessee or IMTRACE2 in Texas. The tracking systems allow providers to ensure patients return for their second dose and to identify any adverse reactions. The use of such information for health initiatives, not immigration crackdowns, is a nuance that providers struggle to explain. Patients, particularly those of immigrant origin, are highly sensitive to sharing family details. Brian Hale, executive director of Neighborhood Health, a community clinic in Nashville, wrote to Tennessee health officials in December. "If we ask them to provide this information to providers they do not know, they will be even more reticent to have their families get vaccinated."
The debate.
U.S. President Joe Biden ordered military airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. The military action, the first of its kind under U.S. President Joe Biden, has been met with negative reactions, with many observers likening Biden's approach to that of his hawkish predecessor, Donald Trump. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. Iran has repeatedly rejected any role in the attacks targeting American bases in Iraq. Iraqi resistance forces have been fighting remnants of the Takfiri-Daesh terror group across border regions of Iraq and Syria in coordination with the governments in both Arab countries. Damascus has censured the U.S. air raid, describing it as cowardly and a bad sign from the new U.S. administration. For more on that story, we're joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who's with us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, what more details do you have to share with us and our viewers?
Yes, the Syrian Foreign Ministry issued a statement on this development, saying that Syria strongly condemns what it described as the cowardly U.S. aggression on Deir ez-Zor governorate, particularly areas on the Syrian-Iraqi borderline, warning that the aggression would lead to consequences that escalate the region, the entire region over here. Also, the Foreign Ministry added that the aggression is a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The Foreign Ministry's statement also said that this aggression is a negative sign of the policies of the new U.S. administration, which should abide by international legitimacy, not by the law of the jungle, according to the statement of the Foreign Ministry. The Foreign Ministry also demanded the United States to change its aggressive policies towards Syria and stop supporting and investing in various terrorist organizations across the Arab country. The Foreign Ministry referred also that recently the United States, U.S. forces in Syria transported hundreds of Daesh terrorists, for example, from prisons under the control of the SDF, the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, to its base, illegal base, of course, in Al-Tanf area on the Syrian-Iraqi borders. It is to be mentioned that the United States' presence is illegal in Syria without a UN mandate, without the authorization of the Syrian government. The United States and the U.S.-led coalition carried out in the past years dozens of airstrikes that killed hundreds of Syrian civilians, destroyed the infrastructure, and also destroyed public and private property. And finally, in the statement, the Foreign Ministry called on the United Nations to shoulder its responsibilities in preserving international peace and security and take swift action to stop one of its permanent member states, which is the United States, from carrying on its crimes and aggression on a sovereign country like Syria.
All right, thanks a lot. Mohammed Ali joining us from Damascus. Our guest for this debate, Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, we have National Co-Director, the International Action Center, Ms. Sarah Flounders, joining us from New York. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. Mr. Kovalik, what does this attack say about U.S. President Joe Biden's approach to foreign policy?
Well, I think it says what many of us feared, and that is that he is going to be a very aggressive president when it comes to military action. You mentioned at the outset of the broadcast, you compared him to his hawkish predecessor, Trump. I'm not sure Trump was any more hawkish than Obama, and I'm not sure Biden will be less hawkish than Trump. My guess is it'll actually be more so. And this is a signal of that. This is an unlawful attack he engaged in. It's illegal under international law. There was no security authorization for it. It wasn't done as an act of self-defense. And it was a war crime. So I think he's signaling, you know, he keeps saying America's back. And what he means by that is the 82nd Airborne is back to start bombing people. And that's a shame.
Sarah Flounders, what do you think is behind the decision to carry out this attack?
Well, I think, as was just said, President Biden is really sending a message that not to expect anything different than previous U.S. presidents in terms of criminal, illegal activity. It's an absolute war crime. I mean, the U.S. has no business being in Syria, has no business being in the region at all. They use the flimsiest excuse that's even imaginable, that an Iraqi resistance group backed by Iran, all of this supposed, and for that reason they're bombing Syria. I mean, Even here in the U.S., how on earth is that understandable to anyone? But it's saying that the U.S. needs no excuse to continue its intervention. The U.S. has been bombing Syria since 2014, and from the very beginning was part of this effort to bring down Syria, to destroy Syria, to pull it apart. From 2011, a regime change operation is what they called it. And this is Biden signaling that there is no real change in policy. It shows enormous hostility. Also, it's openly said this is to be a message to Iran. It's to be a message to Iraq. It's to a message also to the people here in the U.S. who have expectations about Biden, that maybe he would speak for Amazon workers who are desperately trying to organize a union, more than a million low-wage workers at stake, one warehouse they're organizing. Biden won't say a word. Won't say a word. They're still waiting for a stimulus bill here for millions and millions of people who are desperate. But they could carry out, at enormous expense, a bombing run in Syria. And that is criminal toward the people of Syria, but it's also criminal toward the people here in the U.S. who needed and expected that there would be some change. And of course, there's not.
Daniel, Damascus has censured the U.S. air raid, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new U.S. president. What do you think would be the fallout from this attack?
Well, I think that any chance of the nuclear deal with Iran being put back in place between the U.S. and Iran, I think that's – there was slim hope of that anyway, given Biden's position on that, but I think now – that's probably finished. And I think that he, by this bombing, wanted to send the message that there's no rapprochement with Iran coming from him. He sent that message loud and clear, and so, and I'm sure Iran got the message that, again, it's going to be business as usual between the U.S. and Iran, which means sanctions are going to stay in place, which means ordinary Iranians are going to continue to suffer. So that's going to be one fallout. I think a lot of the world, even in Europe, is going to be more wary of the Biden administration. I think there were some amongst world leaders who hoped he would be more diplomatic than Trump, that he would use peaceful means to try to deal with conflicts with other countries. And in fact, Biden, you know, said so, that he would use peaceful means first to deal with other countries. And what he's shown by his actions is he has no intention of doing that. He is going to shoot first and ask questions later.
Sarah Flounders, hours after the U.S. attack, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, along with his Syrian counterpart, they both emphasize the need for Western countries to abide by U.N. Security Council resolutions regarding Syria. The question is the law. It hasn't really been a concern for Washington, especially when it comes to Syria, has it?
This is so absolutely lawless. There's no concern for even a fig leaf of cover on this, not at all. And we should just keep in mind that the U.S., with no justification, has absolutely made every effort to stop Syria from rebuilding. After these 10 years of hugely destructive war, Syria, at heroic effort, defeated U.S. attempts to overthrow the government. But the sanctions, which would enable absolutely normal trade and rebuilding, are attempting to strangle Syria, as they are attempting to strangle Iran and the whole region, because it shuts down any relations between each of the countries of the region. And that's what it's also meant to do, to push back development, to push back solidarity. And I don't think it's going to have that impact. I think it will, if anything, harden, toughen the resolve in Syria and in Iran, in Iraq too. So the U.S. has shown that their aims, they can be pushed back by people's mobilizations. They have been pushed back. U.S. was literally pushed out of Iraq by millions of people, by real effort, pushed out of Syria. but they keep trying. They really, it's relentless, and it's criminal. And as I say, it has to be the countries of Europe and here in the U.S. which demand a stop of this criminal activity.
Daniel Kovalik,
it shouldn't be only the people of Syria and Iran speaking on this. Really, the people of the whole world need to denounce this.
Let's go over to Pittsburgh again. Daniel Kovalik, the Russian foreign minister, said that the U.S. military is present on Syrian soil illegally and in violation of all norms of international law. China has warned against any action that would further complicate the situation in Syria. An analyst that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV said that Washington might be intending to relaunch the war on Damascus, the one that Biden's old partner Barack Obama started. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that's a great danger. And again, that the Democrats and frankly, the more liberal media, for lack of a better word, have signaled that that's what they want for years. I mean, the Democrats and, outlets like New York Times, NPR, were constantly attacking Trump for every position he took, which is fine. I mean, I have no problem with that. But the one thing they would applaud him for is when he bombed Syria. They were clear that that's what they want, more bombing. They made it clear they didn't want Trump to get out of Afghanistan like he was actually seeming to try to do. So, yeah, I think this is the plan. I think that the goal is to destroy Syria. The U.S. government has on a few occasions acknowledged they cannot overthrow Assad. And so clearly the goal is simply to destroy the country. And now the last figure I saw is you have 12 million Syrians who are starving due to the sanctions, the Caesar sanctions. So I think they are going to continue to sow chaos and destruction in the Middle East. And I say that very sadly, but that's what I see happen.
Sarah Flounders, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, he recently said that Moscow had received unconfirmed information that the United States is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. How inconsistent has the U.S. been in its policy in Syria? Many believe it's impossible to predict whether the U.S. will stay or leave.
Well, the U.S. policy has been consistent in terms of war on the world. And in that, they are signaling that they plan to continue that relentless war. And it is also a war that is absolutely destroying the U.S. We have the highest by every count of deaths from COVID because there is no health infrastructure. There's a huge military infrastructure. They know what's on every one of 800 military bases around the world. They know they can, with their satellites, monitor everything, and yet they can't get out vaccines in the U.S. They can't give emergency supplies in the midst of a horrendous cold snap that's hit Texas and parts of the U.S. South, and people are freezing without electricity, without heat. They can't provide those things. They can't provide the most basic things here for the population. And they can't provide vaccines for the global South, for the people of the world, or the people of the U.S. But they can provide bombs. They can provide destruction, because that is profitable. And that's how they calculate it. They don't calculate it at all with people need peace, and they need health care, and they need good food. Those are absolute human needs. And instead, this policy is set by those who profit from war, and it's enormously profitable, billionaires. So it's destructive, and really those links need to be made more and more so that people here in the U.S. understand who's responsible when they don't have heat or jobs or a vaccine. Who's responsible? This government that cares more about war.
Daniel Kovalik, the attacks in Iraq supposedly against U.S. targets, which have often had little impact, They've escalated over the past year, especially since the Iraqi parliament passed a law that mandated a full withdrawal of all foreign troops from the country. Many are saying that the rise in such activities are apparently aimed at creating a sense of insecurity in Iraq and providing a pretext for the U.S. to keep its troops and forces in the country. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, yeah, so though it's a strange argument, right, it's a circular argument, to be in a country illegally like the U.S. is, and then to say when, you know, national forces then attack them because they want them out, as we would in the U.S. if someone invaded us and stayed for years, and then to say, well, we have to stay because our presence is causing this reaction, but we have to stay to counter that reaction. It makes no sense, but that is U.S. military policy. We create the crisis, and then we stay to stomp out the crisis or to claim to. It's just completely irrational to any, you know, honest thinking person.
Sarah Flanders, I see you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, it's true. Any thinking person would say this is a criminally insane policy, and we're paying with lives in Syria, with lives around the world, and with lives here at all that is not being done in order to continue a war on the world. I just can't say how even disheartening, not that I had any expectation about Biden or the Democratic Party, but there was a certain expectation that there would be maybe even some breathing room, or that there would be some attention to the needs here. But it's really clear that they intend to keep military presence every single place they can, and to expand it, to threaten other countries. And so when Biden sends a message like this, we got to take it seriously and up the demands here, because that is the only way I can see, and to absolutely state how there's no excuse. We have to make this completely unacceptable, and to demand they end the sanctions and the bases and the bombings and the war on the world.
I'm going to stay with you, Ms. Flanders. Over the years, there have been numerous reports about the infiltration of Daesh elements from Syria into Iraq under the protection and logistical assistance of U.S. troops, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and its affiliates, which have been integrated into Iraq's regular forces. They're deployed on the Syrian border, and they're helping the army to stem the movement of the terrorists between the two countries. Do you think maybe that's why they're being targeted by the U.S.?
Well, certainly the U.S. wants to continue to use Daesh forces. They want to use everywhere they can the most reactionary forces who only seek to destroy. And in the same way that their alliances are with completely criminal monarchies who don't represent the population, such as Saudi Arabia. So it's not surprising that they would use Daesh, ISIS forces in Iraq, in Syria, and use as a threatening force in other countries of the world, and then it gives them an excuse to say they're going in to fight these forces. Well, maybe folks bought that back in 2014 and 2015, but I don't think anybody accepts that any longer. They know who pays and who transports these forces, who protects them in supposed prisons, and then moves them out in order to carry out destruction again.
Sure. One last question for Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh, Syria's new permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sabah. He stressed that the politicization of the Syrian humanitarian crisis has increased the suffering of people in the war-ravaged country, and Western sanctions against his country have prevented Syrians from acquiring their basic commodities. Why are Syrians being collectively punished by Western countries, namely the U.S.?
Well, this is standard operating procedure. Many countries are being punished. Many populations are being punished by the West, and in particular by the U.S., because they are standing firm against U.S. aggression, against U.S. intervention, against U.S. imperialism. And when you do that, you're punished. That is how it goes. That's how the U.S. has operated since its inception. That is the nature of the beast, unfortunately.
All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guests, Professor of International Human Rights, Daniel Cavalli, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to a national co-director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, joining us from New York. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
Thank you.
Good night.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu Alaikum. Heaven in Grief is a special program on the occasion of the demise of Lady Zainab Salamullah Alaiha, the messenger of the event of Karbala. I'm Fatima Shamili, and we have the honor of being in the presence of Sister Dr. Radia Batul Najafi. Assalamu Alaikum.
Wa Alaikum Assalam Wa Rahmatullah.
Thank you so much for once again joining us.
Jazakumullah khair.
And enlightening us with your informative lecture. Inshallah, we will have another very good show. So about the life of Lady Zainab Salamullahi Alaiha, I think that a little bit of injustice is being done to Lady Zainab, because she was in her middle ages when she went to the event of Karbala, right? She was in her 50s, I believe.
Exactly.
And we only hear about her role in the event of Ashura, whereas it took 50 years of training and education and self-sacrifice and all of that for Zainab to become Zainab and to be prepared for what happened to her in her 50s. But mostly when we talk about her, we listen to a grieved lady who is grief-stricken. She is mourning the martyrdom of her brother, which was happening in front of her. She had the responsibility of taking care of the tents of her brother's family and his wives and his children. But there were also definitely happy moments in her life, you know, that when she was presented in the presence of the caliph and when she went to the court and everybody sitting there in their simple-minded thoughts, you know, making fun of this family who are now here as our slaves, she says, "Ma ra'aytu illa jamila." I saw nothing but beauty. And this is the most tragic event of history that we're talking about. So what happened that culminated in such mentality in the personality of Lady Zainab?
Yeah, beautiful question, mashallah, full of wisdom. We are just discussing about a lady, Zainab, even the name Zainab. I truly feel, as you said, you know, we have to start from her, you know, like the before Karbala period and time. So I truly feel that, you know, like the Panjatan alayhi salam, the five holy personalities, all of them together, if they want to decorate a personality, a beautiful mindset, a beautiful, you know, human being, that would be Zainab Kubra, salamullah alayha. Because, you know, she was so fortunate to have all five holy personalities in her life. You know, all of them, like she had the five ascending nur and light, and again khair and beauty, you know. And number two, which I was just thinking when you were, mashallah, talking, that, you know, even whatever is in our